It's a movement, but it's about people. Be the People is about we the people joining forces to reclaim and reshape the best of our nation's time-treasured traditions. Each week, we offer insightful interviews with movers and shakers from all different spheres of life. And now, please welcome Dr. Carol Swain.
Welcome to the Be the People show. I have a topic today that's very different from what I usually talk about on the show. Today, I'm going to be interviewing a young woman that was born disabled. Often we spend our lives not thinking that much about the disabled unless we're in a situation where we work with someone or we have members of our family who happen to be disabled. And in my particular case, I take care of my mother. So she lives in my home. She's disabled. We have caregivers. And for several years, we did not have a handicapped accessible van. And that meant when I took my mother to the doctor, or I took her somewhere, we had to lift her in and out of the car seat. And that was very difficult. And I can remember times that her legs would give out and I would have to ease her down, you know, on the pavement and wait for a kind passerby. And so I'm somewhat familiar with some of the challenges of the disabled, but it's nothing like what my next guest has endured because she was born disabled. And so I would like for you to help me welcome Melissa Ortiz to the Be the People show. And Melissa was born in the South, and she is someone that has never allowed her handicap to slow her down. She is not a victim. She's an activist. She's a patriot. And she's gone many places that some of us have not visited because she refuses to allow her physical condition to slow her down. And so, Melissa, welcome to the Be the People show.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Swain. I am thrilled to be here. Thank you for having me.
And so, Melissa, where were you born? And I want to know about your family. And how did you get all that spunk?
Oh, my goodness. I come from a long line of spunky women and spunky Southern women. And they just, the joke is that Jewish mothers tell you, oh, you can do this. Southern mothers look at you and say, you will do this. And so I was born in Atlanta, Georgia, the first person in seven generations of my family not born in Tennessee, but my dad had a business there, so we lived there, and I was born. And I'm the younger of two. I have a sister who's 10 years older than I am, and my parents have been trying to have a baby. My mother was married before, so my sister's from that marriage, and my parents got married. They were high school sweethearts, and just through a long set of circumstances, an abusive marriage to be exact on the part of my mom, my mom divorced and she moved back to town where she grew up in Tennessee and met my dad. And 6 weeks later, they were married and they tried for 5 years to have a baby. And along I came, and they knew almost immediately that there were problems because my mom was really, really sick. And so she just persevered. And after they took me 2 months early and I was born, and I managed to thrive through this.
What was it like for your family adjusting to that? And did the doctors diagnose your condition before you were born, or was it a surprise? And I don't remember whether or not you've actually said what the condition was.
Oh, I have spina bifida, and actually that was not correctly diagnosed until about 5 years ago. So I'll just give you the brief version of that. They were surprised. My parents were living apart. They were happily married, but my mother was in graduate school, and so they were able to kind of pinpoint when my mom had gotten pregnant. And she did not think she was pregnant because they had been trying for so long, and she got into glue and pesticide fumes. Then they took me 2 months early because she was hemorrhaging. And it was a big surprise that they told my mom early on, as soon as they found out she was pregnant and she was having so much difficulty, they said, you know, we really feel like the better option here is to do a DNC because you are not going to survive this, and the baby is most certainly not going to survive. And so they, my parents refused. They were not yet Christians. They were churchgoers, but they weren't Christians. And they said, no, we want to try to do this. And my mom went to bed. When I was born, I was not as responsive as a newborn should be. And they really didn't think I'd survive the first year. And because I was born 2 months before they were prepared for me to be born, I came home and my first bed was a turkey box, because my dad was a meat packer and they didn't have a bassinet yet. And the thing that was the right size was a crate that you send turkeys around in. So that was the first thing I slept in.
I heard this politically incorrect joke many years ago, and so I may get in trouble for saying this, but there was a comedian, and he said, and this was probably in the 1970s, he said that he ran into this family and they were so poor that the baby had to sleep in the box the TV came in.
that's about the situation I was in. And I had parents who really loved me. I had a sister who loved me. She wrote a poem about the day that I was born. And I do know that she felt ignored growing up because I was so needy. Even though she really loved me, she still felt ignored. And my dad provided well for us. We lived well. And then my dad died when I was 5. And so my mother was left at not quite 39 years old with a daughter in teenage rebellion and a daughter with significant disability.
Now, Melissa, how much older is your older sister?
10 years.
Oh, so she would have been almost like a caretaker too, because at 10 years old, you can help.
Exactly. And, you know, she had things that she wanted to do, and she still is to this day a very accomplished equestrian, and she had things that she wanted to go and do, and just told my parents that she wasn't going to babysit me. So my activism, that's kind of how my activism got started. There was a meeting one night, I was about 4, because it was about a year before my dad died, and my sister had to be at the barn, and we didn't have any household help and couldn't keep a babysitter. And he looked at me and he said, well, Sweet Pea, it's you and me tonight. I've got to go to a meeting. You're going with me. Behave yourself. So he put me on his hip, and by that time I was trying to walk, so I had these little short leg metal braces on and high top shoes, and I was dressed to the nines. My mom always made sure I was dressed to the nines, and off we went to this meeting. Now, we got there, and my dad said, this is a campaign office, Melissa. They won't have any toys for you. I have to go to this meeting. I'm going to leave you here with this lady. You do exactly what she says do. And little did I know that she was in charge of the whole campaign office, and she put me to work licking envelopes and licking stamps. And I don't know how big the mailing I did. I know it was very big, and I knew my numbers well enough that I was able to help them start sorting by zip code. I didn't want to leave when the night was over, and my dad came out and got me, and I didn't want to go, and he knew that I'd had a good time, and the lady in charge called me over to her desk, and she said, I have something for you. I said, yes, ma'am, and she said, hold out your hand. She handed me 3 silver dollars.
Oh, so that was your first job?
Yes, ma'am, that was my first job and my first activism, and she said, people that work get paid, and I've never forgotten that, and that was in 1970.
Do you mind sharing your age with our listeners?
Oh, not at all. Not at all. I'm 53. I'll be 54 in March. And the doctors never thought I would live this long. They thought maybe I would live to be 30 if they were lucky.
Well, you certainly don't look in your 50s. So you've taken really good care of yourself. We're going to take a break.
Thank you.
And when I return, I want to talk about some of the things you've done, how your political career, your activism, how it's advanced.
Each week, the Be the People show presents interviews with insightful guests from the world of politics, religion, media, and culture. The Be the People show is on podcast. It offers bonus footage. To listen to Be the People online, go to the BeThePeopleNews.com website and subscribe to the Be The People podcast, heard also on the America Out Loud Network.
It's your news and entertainment network. News blogs, informative podcasts, entertaining videos, or listen to 24/7 talk radio on our free apps on Apple, Android, or Alexa. We the People, AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
I'm back with my guest, Melissa Ortiz, and we're talking about her life. She has spent her life as an American with disabilities. And so, Melissa, you talked about your first job as a small child. What was school like? Because I know you've gone to college and you've done so many things.
Yes, ma'am. I was blessed. We lived right across the street from the elementary school where I would start first grade. My mother, at the time in Georgia, kindergarten was not mandatory, but my mother put me in a kindergarten in Atlanta, a private kindergarten in an Episcopal school that gave me good socialization, and it was a mainstream kindergarten. I didn't need special education from an academic standpoint. The students were very nice. I usually had somebody to play with, and then when I started first grade, it was right across the street from our house. I had surgery that summer, and I was in a wheelchair. Mom just pushed me across the street, and she looked at me, and she said, "You will do everything that is asked of you today, and you will be a good girl." And they pulled away a desk in the first grade classroom and put a table, wheeled me up under that table, and so we began. Not long after school started, I learned to read very early. My mother and my grandmother before her and my great-grandmother before that were all teachers, and we have lots and lots of teachers in our family. So the idea was, well, let's teach her to read. Since she can't run and play with other children, let's teach her to read so she'll have something to do. And when I entered first grade, I was reading almost on an eighth grade level, which frustrated my teacher to no end.
What level?
Eighth grade level by the first grade.
Well, you must be a genius.
No, and I still love books. I would almost, as much as I love to talk and I love people, one of my favorite things to do is go around the room with my friends with hot beverages and read books. Started first grade, but I didn't want to do math, and all I wanted to do was read and do English type things. So my teacher had to send home a note within the first couple of weeks of school. Melissa is a good student, but she must do all of the assignments that are assigned to her, not just the ones that she likes. And then the next note went home that said, "Melissa is a good student. She's doing these things that are assigned to her, but she must do her own work instead of asking someone else to do the things that she doesn't know how to do or doesn't like to do." I was asking for help on things like math and things to do with numbers because that was just something I couldn't grasp. I could not grasp numeric concepts. I could read, and I read well, and I loved literature, and I distinctly remember reading aloud from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang in the first grade to my classmates as they were trying to do their math homework or math seat work. And I did not understand my math seat work, so I reverted to what I understood. I still don't like math, but I'll do it. And we found out, I taught school myself for a while, and my principal was the one who determined. I began to teach school in the 90s. It was kind of a second career, side career for me. And I taught school, and my principal said, "You're numerically dyslexic."
Really? I
had never heard of it either. But it turns out that what I was doing was flipping numbers and putting, you know, say the tens number where the ones go and the ones number where the hundreds go and things like that. And it's not, I didn't realize I was doing it.
Well, I think a lot of people out there have that problem. I mean, not, I mean, I was always good with the verbal stuff. Math was a challenge. Mm-hmm. I did what I had to do to get through graduate school. I took the stats, and it was almost like math and me was like water on a duck's back. It just rolled off. As soon as I got my grade, yes, and I got out of the class, it just didn't stay with me the way some other things
did. No. And I felt better when I met my husband because he's the same way. He is not a math guy. He had to take statistics in graduate school, and it was like water off a duck's back with him. So,
okay, well, that's enough about math.
Enough about that terrible subject.
Let's fast forward to college, and I see you have a bachelor's in criminal justice and one in broadcast communications. What led you to choose that unusual combination?
Well, I chose that combination. My original major was broadcast communications with a minor in political science. And another thing that I don't do real well with is learning foreign languages. And I could not graduate from Belmont College in Nashville. It's now Belmont University, but then it was Belmont College. And I could not graduate without 3 semesters of a foreign language with a BA. And a communications degree was a BA. And I got closer and closer to graduation, and I could not get those French classes or Spanish classes out of the way. And so I said, you know, what am I going to do? And they said, well, the only thing that you can do is switch to a Bachelor of Science degree. I said, well, the only thing I'm interested in is criminal justice, and the only criminal justice majors at Belmont College are boys. And I don't know if I can take being in class with a bunch of college-age men all the time. And they said, well, you go home, take the weekend, think about it, make the decision, and let us know, because you need to graduate at some point, because I was closing in on 4 years at this point. And I decided that I'd always loved a good mystery, and I have a very analytical mind as far as, well, what makes somebody do what they do? I've never cared what somebody did so much as why they did it. And that fit right in with the criminology, so I took criminal justice, and turns out I really loved it, and I was good. I was really good at the theories and the understanding and things like that, and I very much enjoyed the criminology classes, and there was no math involved. And so I got that major added on. I added on the classes that I needed to transition from a Bachelor of Art to a Bachelor of Science, and graduated in 5.5 years when most people graduate in 4. It took me 5.5.
And then you got involved in politics, or is that the sequence?
No, ma'am. I was involved in politics all along. I was involved in politics from that very first time that I licked envelopes. I took an interest after that. I was a lot of things happened when I was 4 years old. I got politically active, not just by working in that campaign and that being my first job, but I wrote a letter to the President of the United States. And I asked him for a contribution to the March of Dimes.
And who was the president at that time?
It was President Nixon. And it was before he left office. And I wrote him and asked him for a contribution to the March of Dimes of Georgia, because I was a poster child. And so not only did he give me a dime, he sent me $100 in dimes.
Oh, wonderful.
And a letter signed by him and the First Lady that I still have somewhere. And you would think I would have it framed on the wall, but we moved, and I don't know what has happened to that frame since we moved, but I know that it's here somewhere. And so that's how my activism started. I thought, well, if he cared enough to write to me, I should care enough about what's going on with him. And my parents talked to me about politics, and they talked to me about the fact that one vote makes a difference. And so all through high school, elementary school, high school, and college, I couldn't vote, so I volunteered on campaigns, and I did what I could. And then the very first time I was able to vote was the Reagan election in 1984, the presidential election in 1984. And I remember being so proud when I got my absentee ballot. That was in the days when they sent it to you on a piece of styrofoam, and you had to poke holes in it, and then you sent it back. And I just remember being so excited that I had actually helped choose the President of the United States. And Then on a local level, I stayed active and was actually encouraged to run for state rep when I graduated from college.
Did you actually do this?
I did not do it. I decided that I wanted to go back to school and get my teaching certificate, so that's what I did instead.
Okay, we're going to take another break, and when we return, I want you to talk about what you've been doing in recent years and also how people can help Americans with disabilities.
You're listening to Be the People. Dr. Carol Swain is the mind behind Be the People News, radio, podcast, and YouTube. Be the People's mission is dedicated to empowering individuals to think independently, understand their responsibility, and believe in their unique ability to make a difference in the world. Check out Carol's work at BeThePeopleNews.com. To invite Carol to be your next keynote speaker, go to BeThePeopleNews.com. That's BeThePeopleNews.com.
I'm back with my guest, Melissa Ortiz, and we are talking about the issue. We're talking about her life as a person who's been disabled, but she's really an activist and an inspirational person that we can all learn from. And so, Melissa, in recent years, you've been involved, I believe you've been a poster child for New York, and you've also been involved with the Trump administration.
I married my husband in 2002 and got involved with the Republican Women of New York, and anything that we felt like we could mount a candidate for, we did, and I collected petition signatures and whatever they needed me to do. Then in 2004, I became Ms. Wheelchair New York 2005, which is pageant similar to the Miss America pageant, but they don't have talent, they don't have bathing suit competition, but it's to highlight the achievements of women with professional women with disabilities. So my husband said, I think you need to do this, and I did, and I won. And then I went on to compete in Ms. Wheelchair America and came in fifth place overall there. Sixth place, because I was fifth runner-up, so it was sixth place, and continued to be involved. And I ended up in Washington, the place I always wanted to live but never thought that I would get the chance. My husband found a graduate school that he really liked for his master's in counseling, and it was here in D.C., so here I came and immediately was able to become involved in the 2008 presidential election. Of course, McCain lost, and I spent the next time after that trying to figure out what was going to come next. And then a little thing called the Taxpayers March on D.C. that was attended by 2.1 million people on September 12th of 2009 happened, and I was one of the instigators of that and organizers, and made sure that everybody had a way to, you know, I managed 400 volunteers and was in charge of the disability access component of it, which was difficult, but we made it happen. That I was drawn into the fight to keep the United States from ratifying the UN Treaty on Disability, which would have been a terrible mistake, because it would have stripped us of our sovereignty. People thought that it was going to be a good thing for people with disabilities, and not only would it have cost us our national sovereignty, it would have cost individuals with disabilities their decision-making ability and their autonomy.
Okay, that's an issue that probably most of us have not followed, and so I'm glad that you were involved with that. Tell us about your work with the Trump administration.
I was originally a Ted Cruz supporter, and when he withdrew from the nomination process, I began to look for reasons that, and I knew that Donald Trump was a good man, and he hadn't been my original choice. And then the more I learned about him, the more excited I was about him. And I proudly cast my vote for him in November of 2016. And then fast forward to 2017, not long after he was inaugurated, a friend of mine who worked at the White House called me and said, listen, we have the healthcare discussion going on, and we don't have anybody at the table with a pre-existing condition or a disability. And I need for you to come to this meeting and talk about things from that perspective and whether or not we're going the right direction with healthcare. I was excited to do so, and I went to that meeting, and it had its twists and turns, and it was a great meeting. And in that meeting was Secretary Tom Price, and he pulled me aside after the meeting. He already knew who I was, and we had worked together on some things, and he said, what are you doing these days? I said, well, I'm looking for my next job. And he said, I want you to come work for me at Health and Human Services. And within 90 days, it takes a long time to get verified and get all your background checks in and everything. Within 90 days, I was sworn in as Commissioner of the Administration on Disability, and I worked really hard to make sure that good policy was coming about and that people with disabilities understood that President Trump and other Republicans really did care about them and weren't out to strip them of their dignity and their services.
And we're coming to the close of this part of the show. For people that would like to know more about Melissa, there is bonus footage in the podcast. So Be the People is a radio show, but also a podcast. And some of the things that we will discuss after the show ends is her faith, as well as whatever comes up. And so in the time that's left, Melissa, could you tell people how they can reach you and what they can do to help Americans with disabilities? And so that's a lot to talk about, but I'd like to
hear that. Well, first of all, I have a website. It's DC Bell, B-E-L-L-E on wheels, dcbellonwheels.com. My email is wheeled wonkette, like a wheelchair and a wonkette, W-H-E-E-L-E-D, W-O-N-K-E-T-T-E, @gmail.com. And people can help people with disabilities by first and foremost offering them the opportunity to work in a job that is equal to their skill sets, even if it means that they have to make some workplace accommodations. If you don't know how to do that, get in touch with me and I will tell you how to do that. The average cost of a workplace accommodation so that you can hire somebody with a disability is $500, and there are tax incentives and community organizations that will help you meet that cost and meet that accommodation.
I'd like to thank you for being a guest on the Be the People show, but I'd also like to ask you to hang around for a few more minutes so that we can continue our conversation on the podcast. Can you do that?
Yes, ma'am. I can do that.
All right. And for the listeners out there, I hope you've enjoyed this interview with Melissa Ortiz. And it has caused me to think more about Americans with disabilities and what we can do to help them. And Melissa is so inspirational as a patriot. She is not someone that's a victim. She is someone that's actually out there being the people who change America. And so, as always, it's up to us, the we the people, to be the people who change our nation and our world. Until next time. Melissa, thank you for being on the Be the People show. I have a question that I'd like for you to talk about. It's not really a question. I know that you're a person of faith. I'd like for you to share with our listeners how your faith has helped you in your walk. I did notice this during the earlier part of our interview, that you have not been complaining, you've not been blaming people, and I'm sure you've encountered some discrimination along the way, because I know how humans are flawed. But you don't focus on that.
No, ma'am. And I'll say I even encountered discrimination working Trump administration, not from him, but from other people. I can't complain because I have two life verses. One of them is John 10:10, and it talks about that Jesus said that he came that we might have life and have it more abundantly, and that the thief comes to kill, steal, and destroy. And I don't want to kill, I don't want to steal, and I don't want to destroy, and I don't want to be killed, and I don't want to have stolen from me, and I don't want to be destroyed. So I choose to live in the abundance that Christ brings, no matter what comes my way. And then my other life verse is that I want to know Christ through the power of his rising, sharing his suffering, and conformed to his death. And I truly believe that suffering or discrimination, while they're ugly, no matter what form suffering comes in, whether it's illness or pain or anything, they're ugly. They conform me to Christ. If I respond the right way, they conform me to the image of the Son of the Most High God. And what greater thing could I ask for than those things? I have days that I get upset. I have days that my feelings are hurt, or that I'm really beyond my feelings being hurt, I'm hurt. And it's ugly and it's hurtful. But I have a good support system, and most of all, I know that God loves me and that He has planned for me. And that all of these things, even as hurtful as they seem at the time, are part of the plan and part of my ultimate good.
And this other thing, Melissa, is I'm sure you know that there's a push by the abortion industry to abort any baby that isn't, quote, perfect. And so I would imagine that there are fewer babies being allowed to live who have handicaps these days. Have you been involved with the abortion industry, the pro-life side?
Oh, yes, ma'am. I've been involved in the pro-life movement in two different ways. First of all, I have spina bifida, and 95% of the babies diagnosed in the womb as having spina bifida are aborted. And that to me is wrong, because my life has been nothing short of amazing. I can't imagine it being any better. And even if I could walk, I can't imagine it being better. So I've been involved there. I talk to doctors, I talk to parents, I talk to children who've been allowed to be born with disabilities about that it's their choice to make their life amazing and to go out and do everything that they can. But I talk to parents and tell them that I haven't suffered in a cruel way, that suffering is part of life, and that my suffering has just taken a little bit of a different form. And I urge parents, if they find out that they've got a diagnosis of a child with a disability, to allow that child to be born and let it go change the world by its presence. On the other end, with the flip end of euthanasia and medical assistance in dying, physician-assisted suicide, whatever you want to call it, I have been involved because it is quickly coming down the tracks with states that have passed a physician-assisted suicide and made it legal. Insurance companies are beginning to not pay for what people need. They would rather pay for the drug cocktail to commit suicide than they would for palliative care and for hospice care. And the way that I've been involved in that is that I've written insurance companies, I've testified as an expert witness, and I've actually gone one-on-one with members of Compassionate Choices about why you don't murder people simply because they're dying or they have a terminal diagnosis. I've had the honor of working alongside people truly had terminal diagnoses like cancer and brain cancer. And J.J. Hansen from upstate New York is one of my heroes. He recently went to be with the Lord, and he fought until he could not communicate any longer to live and to have a productive life and to talk about why having a terminal illness or a disability does not mean that your life is not worth living.
Well, you are so inspirational, and I am quite happy that you agreed to be a guest today on the Be the People show. And I hope that I hope to follow your career and learn more about you. And I thank you so much for your service and just for all the people that you are helping. And I'm sure you'll be one of those people that when you get to heaven, and you know all the people you touch, that you're going to be astonished at the millions of people that you have touched. You had no idea that you were changing lives.
That's what I hope, and it would all be for God's glory, and that's the even better part. I thank you so much for your interest in having me on today, and I look forward to future conversations.
And to my listeners, thank you so much for listening to the Be the People show. Remember that it's up to us, that we are the people who can change our nation. It's the we the people. We're responsible for what we see. So go out there and be the people who change your city, your state, your nation. Until next time.